This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Between beefed-up security and bad weather delays, most of us wind up waiting around at the airport a lot these days, which gives us time to catch a cup of clam chowder at Legal Seafood or pick out a new shirt at Brooks Brothers. In fact, for some people, the airport itself is becoming a destination for shopping, eating, and perhaps most notably, human drama. Movies and TV have been quick to seize on this. Steven Spielberg's film The Terminal tells the story of a man who actually lives at JFK Airport in New York City. A&E's Airline documents the real-life exploits of Southwest Airlines personnel. And this September, a primetime soap called LAX debuts on NBC. Prosaic business trips, emotional reunions, and exquisitely frustrating foul-ups all take place against the bland backdrop of a shopping mall. Later in the program, your remembrances of one of those moments everyone old enough remembers, Apollo 11's landing on the moon 35 years ago today. But first, the culture of America's airports. Call and tell us your airport experiences. Any dramatic moments, a reunion perhaps, or even a chase? What makes a good airport? What makes a bad one? Can they be beautiful? If delays are inevitable, what could make them less onerous? Is there anything airports don't have that you'd like to see there? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now from the studios of KTYD in Santa Barbara, California, is Pico Iyer. He's the author of Global Soul, Jet Lag Shopping Malls and the Search for Home. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Delighted to be here.
Most travel writers describe exotic destinations, far-off places. You've done a lot of that, too, but you also write a lot about airports. How come?
In part because I found that when I was going to Easter Island or North Korea or Bhutan or some very exotic place, some of the dramas and the incongruities that I found in Los Angeles Airport en route were just as exotic and unexpected, as you were saying in your introduction, as anything I saw at the other end. And it struck me that the airport, as you were saying, is a place where more and more of us spend more and more of our time, but we take it for granted and we never actually stop to look at it and think about it as a place.
If I'm not mistaken, for a story, you pulled a Tom Hanks. You actually lived at LAX.
Amazing, yes. I voluntarily committed myself to living there for on and off for about 2 weeks.
What was it like?
Well, I think it grew out of my sense that I calculated a little bit before that I anyway spend 40 days of every year either in an airline or in an airport. So that's 6 weeks of the year anyway that I was spending time in this place. And I think where I chose to concentrate was the international arrivals area. And it seemed to me that you'd see, as you were saying, the most powerful, eternal human dramas, people breaking down and kissing and sobbing and sending loved ones off to war, taking off for funerals and honeymoons, meeting people, loved ones they hadn't seen for 40 years. You'd see all this in the midst of this absolutely post-human environment, as you were saying, the shopping mall, the food court, and the hotel lobby, all brought together. And it seemed to me an interesting way in which people were doing the same things that people have done for 20 or 50 centuries, but in this non-place and in this non-time.
Now, you call it generic space.
Yes, absolutely. I think the fascination of the airport culture is that it's non-culture or it's anti-culture. And I was thinking about it this morning. In some ways, I see the virtue of it, because I think when you're 16 hours out of sync, you don't know if it's night or day, you don't know if you're in north or south. What you want is something familiar rather than something strange. And I think that's why all airports are almost part of the same airport, and they belong to this kind of parallel world of Sbarro and W.H. Smith and Borders and Starbucks.
I forget who said it, but the observation was made recently that in a time when we're all torn between the idea of perhaps becoming victims, it's very comforting to see all those familiar brand names at the airport.
Exactly. If you arrive tomorrow in Bangkok or even in Pittsburgh and you've been spending 15 hours in the air and you don't know quite who you are or where you are, what you want is something that makes you feel at home. And part of the interest of the airport for me is it's not, of course, home, but it's not entirely exotic. But it's almost like the physical equivalent of jet lag. It's this neither here nor there space where we're clutching for anything that will make us feel grounded.
In those 2 weeks when LAX was your home, we can understand how, where and when you went to eat, but there's some basic human needs I'm a little curious about. Did you get a shower anywhere?
Well, I've got to confess, I cheated a little, which is at nighttime I went often stayed in the airport hotels, which are sort of an extension of the airport, but of course do have the conveniences. So I wasn't going through the full Tom Hanksian experience of 24 hours a day in the terminal. But in many airports in the world, I could find showers, and I could also find mini golf courses, microbreweries, porno cinemas, chapels. I mean, it's amazing how airports have taken on all the amenities of a city, even as cities, to me, are looking more and more like airports, because cities are places for people from everywhere who are disoriented.
Here's an email we got from Susan Novak in Norfolk, Virginia. When my husband and I were dating, our best dates were at the airport. We would go and get a sandwich from the deli and then spend hours watching the various stories being played out as people left and other people arrived. We would try to imagine what was going on in their lives. One night we saw a woman clearly saying a very passionate goodbye, only to have a very passionate hello about an hour later from a different man.
And many of those passionate dramas in the airport are with strangers, too. I mean, I think partly because we're displaced and partly because we're anonymous, people strike up very strong, almost extreme relations with people that they've never met before, partly because they know they're never going to meet them again. And, yeah, I think the airport is fascinating in the way that it's a sort of exemption from the rules of the world, and it's an unlegislated place, and so we can be somebody we'd never dare to be elsewhere.
There's also a factor. Most times we have to justify our existence, but when you're traveling, well, you're traveling. That's justification enough. There's nothing else you need to do.
Exactly, and all your needs are taken care of. And I think that's why a lot of homeless people in Los Angeles and New York actually try to locate themselves in airports because, as you were suggesting before, they're climate controlled, the airport, the facilities are nearby, the restaurants are everywhere, and people are in some ways much more unclaimed and unguarded in the airport and much more likely to extend a hand to strangers. It's funny what in response to that email, when I was staying in LAX, I heard from one person who was very, very shy, and she'd never been good at finding the right man. And her assertiveness counselor told her to go to the airport and make eye contact with all the people streaming off the plane that had just arrived from Rio de Janeiro or Paris because they were disoriented and they didn't know what was going on. And the assertiveness counselor said that's the place to conquer your shyness.
There's also the fact that these we all remember those pictures of the doughboys returning from World War I on ships. These days, all the returns, these reunions, are all at airports.
Exactly, yes. And airports in that way are a very emotional place, as I think you were saying. And I often felt that rather than reading an airplane novel, I would just, as the emailer was saying, just sit there and watch these extraordinary five-act dramas explode around me. And they're also places, of course, of great of tension and suspicion because nobody knows really who anyone else is. I remember at Los Angeles Airport, I was told that there are 10 different security agencies working the terminal, and many of them were undercover. And one of the airport officials said to me, well, you know, part of the interest of the airport is nobody knows what anyone else is doing there.
A large part of how we interact and how we feel in airports depends on the design of those structures. George Perinas is Program Manager for Port Columbus International Airport and Chief Aviation Architect for the Michael Baker Jr. Corporation, an engineering and energy services firm that's based in Pennsylvania. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleased to be with you, Neil.
Besides Port Columbus, you've done some work on airports in Pittsburgh, Toronto, Seoul, South Korea. What factors do you take into consideration when you're designing these things?
Well, there are a number of factors to take. Obviously, we talked about the mall, and eventually I'd like to get back to that. But one of the factors we take is to really humanize them. And presently what we're doing is making larger and larger spaces, but not making really locations where people can feel comfortable. The fact that they become larger almost makes them more inhuman, and so therefore more difficult to really comprehend and feel comfortable and spending the number of hours that Pico is talking about. I think it's very important that we as designers around the world who take this problem on every day is to make sure that we're not building temples to ourselves, but rather trying to make the experience more humane and more human for passengers throughout the world.
So not cathedrals, but do you design them for the airplane or for the airplane passenger?
Well, you design them for both. The one thing about airports is they're waypoints. They're not really cities, as Pico says. They're not, and they're not airplanes either. What they are, They're a part destination. It's the first thing you see when you arrive at cities, and it's the last thing you see when you depart them. So in that sense, you're actually saying, this is my city, this is what I'm trying to become, and so you leave an impact on passengers throughout the world. But it isn't fair to put on airports the idea that they are, in point of fact, cities in and of themselves. They do add to the cultural heritage, however. I mean, at its best, certainly Saarinen at TWA and JFK and Dulles understood that. But as everything else, they had a lifespan and try to get security through those, especially TWA now, and you'd be very hard-pressed to do so.
Yeah, Pico Iyer, you talk about airports as sort of a vision of the cities of the future.
Absolutely. Not always an inspiring vision, but I think a realistic one. And I felt, because I traveled a lot in space, to go and spend time at an airport was in a way of traveling in time into the future. Because I think even if airports aren't looking like cities, cities are looking more and more like airports. When I was growing up, I was always excited to be in the airport because it was the only place where I'd see saris and sawakamis and galabeas and all this exotic colors and customs of the world. And, of course, now you can see those on every other street corner of Washington or Vancouver or Paris. And I think cities are probably looking to airports for their cues often as well as the other way around.
Worst airport, Kansas City International, writes Jay from Overland Park, Kansas. Once one passes through security, one cannot go to the restroom without going out of the security area and back through security. No fun for anyone with a need, especially with young children. And that's one thought. Here's another one from Rachel and Rob Kimbrough, parents of Eleanor Jane, 14 months, in Princeton, New Jersey. Hello, our favorite airport is Nashville, Tennessee, BNA. There's a free kids play space with tables of mega blocks and a couple of those bead and wire toys, plus a lot of space to crawl around. It's a great place to kill some time with kids, and we haven't found another one like it. Goodness knows it's a good idea for toddlers to burn off some energy before boarding a flight. I think we can all give that a second. George Perinas, when you visit other airports, presumably to take a look at what works and what doesn't.
Oh, absolutely. In point of fact, when I first started out in the aviation industry, it's the thing I did most. I went from airport to airport in somewhat similar fashion to Pico, but I would stay in one location for maybe 2 or 3 hours. Atlanta was a very good place to do it because it was designed by the aviation industry as opposed to architects, and passenger convenience and taking care of how people move through it wasn't as important as getting aircraft in and out of a facility. But I went throughout Europe and a lot of places through the United States. Many of those are gone now. I've been replaced with much larger facilities. And it's always an experience to do that because there's always an attempt to answer the question. It's a moving target of what will aviation and airports need to be like tomorrow. And yet you need to plan for them today. And you have to convince the carriers that the 3 to 5 cents on the dollar that they are spending on facilities is worthy of that 3 to 5 cents. It's not the easiest task to do many times.
After that email voting Kansas City's airport the worst, we've got another vote, this one from Ron DeShell. The Kansas City International Airport is shaped like a clover leaf, and each gate has its own metal detector. How wonderful that, unlike at Pittsburgh's airport, where I have to stand in line with everyone else in the whole airport, at KCI, I walk in the front door and right to my gate. The only people in the metal detector line are the ones on my flight. Very fast, very convenient, only takes about 3 minutes to get to my car. So you can have a lot of different opinions about the same airport.
Yes.
The Pittsburgh one she trashed, that was one of yours, right?
Yes, it was. And I would like to speak to it just for a moment because...
Well, we have about 20 seconds.
Okay. Everybody calls it a mall. In point of fact, it was inspired by shopping experience. It's two interconnecting shopping roads that are actually intended to be... You're supposed to move along very carefully and very slowly, not necessarily as a mall would be in a traditional setting.
We're talking about airports and their role in modern life. When we come back from a break, we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and more of your emails, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about airports, what we do at them, and what they say about us. Our guests are Pico Iyer, author of the book Sun After Dark, Flights into the Foreign, which is published by Knopf. And we're also talking with George Perinas, who's the program manager for Port Columbus International Airport and an aviation architect for Michael Baker Jr. Corporation, an engineering and energy services firm based in Pennsylvania. Of course, you're invited to join us and tell us how you've whiled away the hours at airports, what you've done, what you've seen. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. And let's go right to Christopher, who's with us from High Point, North Carolina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing I wanted to talk about briefly, I've traveled a lot myself. In fact, I spent 6 months a couple years ago where I pretty much lived in an airport. I was on a plane every other day. I noticed a lot of times when you go into an airport, the airport is generic, of course, also, but you almost yourself become generic. You seem to blend into the other travelers. I've noticed myself doing it and people I was with becoming less of a person, an individual, and more of a traveling group, you know, a kind of a traveling unit with the other passengers. I wanted to see what your Pico thought about that, and here's the discussion on it.
Pico Iyer?
I think that's a wonderful point. It's absolutely true. And I think that's compounded by jet lag. I'm actually in the middle of jet lag myself. I just flew from Japan to California. And I realize and I notice in myself that after a long trip, you're not really on the ground and you're not the self that you would recognize. And I think in some ways we probably become generic in order to protect ourselves. If there's too much of our individuality in the midst of these anonymous spaces, it feels like something rubs off.
George Perinas, is this something you take into account at all?
Of course. The idea, and as I said, every architectural firm and every architect tries to do something inspired in the way of an architecture that is maybe looks like it's indigenous to the area. Denver tried to do that. Lots of places do around the world. In China, there's a design that is somewhat like a butterfly, a Chinese kite. So there's an attempt to try to do that. But but we have to remember ultimately that we're spending, for most part, an hour or less, and if you're unlucky, maybe 2 or 3 hours. But it's only still, as I said, a way station, and you're trying to.
I think Christopher's point is that the airport tends to turn us into this this traveling unit that becomes almost generic. It adjusts our behavior in a way.
Well, one thing I noticed personally is that when I went into the airport, and people I observed, you almost become a different person as part of this group. When I was talking with people, I found myself behaving or acting or conversing in ways that I wouldn't normally do, picking up aspects of the other person I was talking to, picking up aspects of their culture or their mannerisms or their personality, kind of like a group thing, which I always thought was unusual.
Adapting to the group, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting point, Christopher. Thanks very much. Let's take another phone call. This is Lisa, who's with us from Saratoga, California.
Yes, hello. I had a quick story. When we were young teenagers, I have a twin and a brother who's a year younger, so it was three of us. We were traveling back from Colombia before they had any issues with drugs and whatnot. And we had a quick plane change, and since we were traveling alone, we got a suggestion that we not wash our last week's worth of clothes, pack them in very tightly into the first suitcase that we put in front of the customs officer, and hopefully after he got through that explosion of dirty clothes, he wouldn't go through the last two boxes that we had to get through.
We finally found the weapons of mass destruction, did we?
It worked. We made a plane change. After they got through those dirty clothes, they just waved us through. Of course, that was too many years ago to count. So.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that story, Lisa.
Okay.
I was joking, but obviously, George Perinas, the experience of what happened on 9/11 has changed all of our experiences in airports. Describe how you think about that.
Well, it's profound, obviously, and it's obvious level with how it's changed and how despicable an act it was. But in terms of aviation design, someone spoke to Kansas City. It would be very nice to have, if you have 50 gates or 100 gates, to have one place where you walk through a security and then walk on through in terms of that 50 times. But for all intents and purposes, it's very difficult to really economically accommodate that. Now we are all trying to find ways that are that we can actually incorporate as many of these locations, as many of these units in one location. And the reason for that is very simply that in off-peak periods you only use one or two, and in peak periods you may use 15 or 20. Mm-hmm. But the idea that it will be with us forever is not clear. So we as designers have to make sure that that space is usable in other areas and is actually flexible enough to be used in the future for possibly seating or possibly concession space in the future. And that's a real trick in being able to determine how it's going to be used in the future.
From the passenger's point of view, it seems like they're going to be there forever.
Well, that's changing. I think that obviously we're in the midst of this now. It just happened almost yesterday, and I think that we're erring on the side of caution and safety. And I think that we are probably getting there. I think that the fact of the matter is that we still, as we finally, the designers, get to a solution that is actually both palpable for the traveler and the long lines are shortened somewhat, and the experience becomes acceptable, that we will have moved into another phase. And I think that phase will have either, not that we will have conquered the terrorists so much, but we will have at least found another way to get around this hour wait or 15-minute wait or whatever it is.
Now, Pico Iyer, I wanted to ask you, obviously, as we go into airports, we encounter probably the biggest variety of machines that most of us encounter in a short space of time anywhere else. I mean, from these elaborate security devices, the scanners of various types, to the computer kiosks where we can get our e-tickets.
Absolutely. And in fact, once while I was staying at the airport, I decided to fly into Los Angeles from Osaka and to imagine myself as a typical newcomer to America. And the thing that hit me most was, on the one hand, that the airport is so wired, as you were saying, but on the other, that it's so inscrutable, that if I had suddenly arrived in Los Angeles airport from somewhere else, I'd be surrounded by signs and beeping sounds and cell phones and banks of telephones. And in some ways, I would be more disoriented than ever.
I'm always intrigued to find what languages the signs are in. It tells you a lot about the local place. Let's get another caller on the line. Samantha's with us from Chandler, Arizona.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just recently saw a movie called Love Actually, which opens up with the lead character talking about how he loves to go to the airport whenever he's feeling down, just to watch people, you know, as they welcome their families, their loved ones. And it's little vignettes of people, actual travelers at this London airport. And I don't remember which one it is, but, hugging each other, and they're all smiles, of course. And then the one thing that he really hits home with is he says, I don't believe any of the calls made on 9/11 were full of hate. They were all, you know, full of love and how much, you know, everyone cared about their loved ones. And it just, I don't think I've ever seen anyone at the airport, you know, going there to pick up anyone, you know, being angry or anything like that. I always see people who are very happy to see whoever was far away. And airports just seem to me to be almost a reflection on how much we do love each other.
That's interesting. George Perinas, there was a story in the New York Times this past Sunday. I'm sure you saw it. Pico Iyer's featured in it as well. But one of the things that it suggests is that we've come from an era maybe 20 years ago where the airplane was romanticized and the star of movies like Airplane to an era where Love Actually, it's the airport that's the star.
Exactly.
Oh, that's correct.
With the new designs. Yeah.
What do you think is responsible for that transition?
I think what's responsible is the fact that, as Pico suggests, is that the number of passengers that go through airports today is 10-20-fold what it was at the time 10-20 years ago. It's expanding exponentially, and it's becoming much more of our culture. And I'm not saying just the American culture, all cultures. As a result, you do see people of different nationalities going through, and people of some note, and everybody is doing the same thing, trying to get from one place to another. You're part of that experience. We try, again, as designers, to make that experience as pleasurable as we can, knowing that, as I said, change is going to occur, and you're either going to have to get through a line, or you're going to have to try to find your way as quickly as you can to your aircraft.
Samantha, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email from M.K. Fuller in Farmington Hills, Michigan. American airports need what some Japanese facilities have, the coffin hotelu, the small compartments of beds just big enough to accommodate a single adult in repose that are replete with television and alarm clock. What I wouldn't have given when faced with an unforeseen extended delay to have been able to stretch out conveniently and safely. Just my opinion, your results may vary. Pico Iyer, have you ever stayed in one of those coffin hotels?
Only vicariously. I've only watched other people do so. But I think this is obviously the kind of thing that George and his colleagues think a lot about. But I notice that airports which actually have hotels in them instantly feel more humanizing and more familiar and accommodating to the visitor.
Is that right, George?
Yes. That's the last thing I would want to do is stay in one of those places. They're well named.
Let's get another caller in. Kim joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
We love airports. We've been traveling from Portland, Oregon to New York twice a year, every year for the last 9 years with our kids. And, you know, the difference in diversity of people that you see in airports from West, which is very white, then you go to the Midwest and then to New York and then to London, and you get to see people that you never, ever see. And the architecture, let's say the Denver, the tent architecture, we love that. The, you know, how does Kennedy Airport even work? It's such a tight space. You know, all these things, like, we love the airports. The kids love them. They play games and run around. The flat escalators are spectacular. You know, and, you know, we'll even get bumped just to get some extra time because it's just a unique experience, and we can find people that you'd never see anywhere else, you know, in a group, that you can really just watch people. We love them. They're great.
We can switch children, and I think I would be happy with that.
Right. The other, you know, one time when we were growing up, we got stuck in Kennedy Airport for 3 nights with a huge snowstorm.
Oh, my gosh.
We all played baseball and soccer, and everybody pitched in, and blankets were given. It was a great, you know, everybody in airports, they, you know everybody's in the same position, and the people just seem to be great.
I was the guy in the corner fuming.
So that's it. The architecture and everything you get to see, which you just don't get to see all the time.
Okay, Kim, thanks very much.
Okay.
Obviously, in terms of when events like that happen, Pico Iyer, people really do pull together.
Absolutely. And I relate exactly to what the last caller was saying, because, in fact, I began living in an airport when I was 9 years old. My parents were living in California and my school was in England, and I'd fly 3 times a year between Los Angeles and London and back again. And I remember as soon as I'd get to Heathrow Airport, I didn't want to go to my school because there were all kinds of formidable teachers waiting for me, and yet I was free from my parents. And to a 9-year-old, it was absolute heaven. I would sometimes sleep there for 2-3 nights using my suitcase as a pillow, and food was nearby, and the whole human spectacle was around me, and I couldn't imagine a nicer sort of interregnum between these two countries of my parents' house and the boarding school awaiting me.
We're talking about the culture of the airport with Pico Iyer, author of Global Soul, Jet Lag, Shopping Malls, and the Search for Home, and with George Perinas, who's currently the program manager for Port Columbus International Airport. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call in from Al in New York City.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I have. I was listening to your show. It's very interesting. But I've worked at airports for 20 years now, the New York airports and Washington National as well. One thing that I find that's very interesting is that a lot of the older airports get bad rap because they, as airports expand, and what was acceptable 15 years ago as far as amenities is no longer acceptable anymore. And some of the airports just do not have the luxury of expanding, like LaGuardia, where I work now.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at acreage, Kennedy is about 5,000 acres of airport, and LaGuardia, that handles 30% more airplanes, is 1/8 the size, 640 acres for the airport. And sometimes it's just very congested, and there's just no place to grow. But it's a money airport, LaGuardia is, because it's so close to Manhattan, and people like flying out of here because of its location.
Yeah, and you save about $20 in cab fare, too.
Right, and, you know, and it's great, like the Denver's, and where they actually can build something and they design it with the amenities and the comforts in mind, but a lot of these older airports don't have that luxury, and sometimes they get a bad rap because of it.
I wanted to get a comment on that from George Perinas.
Well, they do get a bad rap, and many of them are forced out of business because of it. I think there are some exceptions as national, but just in the New York Times was the closing of the closing of Tempelhof Airport in Berlin, mm-hmm. and it's closing because basically the runways are too short, and it can't sustain the kind of traffic it needs to. And it is a shame because they offered a convenience that the new airports do not offer, that being close in. And you have to trade that off. In Germany, for example, you're very hard pressed to get any expansion on runways. People who live in the proximity of airports almost universally don't like them around you because obviously they see them as noisy and an intrusion on their quiet and private lives. So that's another reason why the inner city ones seem to be going away, and it is a shame because they actually were designed more in the line of railroad stations and in the kind of philosophy that railroad stations used to have. It was close at hand; people could get to them, they could get in and out, and it was a pleasurable experience.
I think that in the case of LaGuardia, the Port Authority does an excellent job with what they have to work with, and
sure. And the Marine Air Terminal, the end of LaGuardia, that's a beautiful old facility, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, considering it was the days of Indiana Jones with the flying boats, and they've come a long
right.
way.
Al, thanks very much.
Sure.
One final email question for you, Pico Iyer. I can't think of any place other than the airplane itself, writes Pat Snyder, where the class system is more striking than at airports. First-class folks have their own shorter check-in lines. They have their own special lounges away from the masses and, of course, get to enter the airplane first.
That's very, very true. But at the same time, one of the fascinations and excitements of the airport is that it's democratic. Even, say, Michael Jordan, if he's flying first class and he's about to go off into the special lounge, he's still there lining up and getting on the plane. And I think one reason that many of us enjoy the airports is it's the one place in public life where we do see Elizabeth Taylor or Bill Clinton or Britney Spears, because they're having to go through the process just the way we are. And even if their lines are shorter and they're whisked off, we still get to see them. I've had more celebrity sightings in airports than in the rest of my life put together, I think.
Pico Iyer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pico Iyer, a travel writer, author most recently of the book Sun After Dark, Flights into the Foreign. He joined us from KTYD in Santa Barbara, California. George Perinas, we thank you for your time today as well.
It was a pleasure, Neil.
George Perinas, program manager for Port Columbus International Airport, chief aviation architect for the Michael Baker Jr. Corporation and engineering and energy services firm, which is based in Pennsylvania. He was with us from the studios of member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. When we come back from a short break, we'll speak with Nick Thiel, the creator of the new NBC drama LAX. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, syndicated columnist Molly Ivins joins us to talk about her new book, Who Let the Dogs In? That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about the culture of airports. Just before the break, we were talking about celebrity spots in the lines at airports. We got this email from Sarah Fisher. Once I saw Bob Dylan at the airport, at least I think it was him. I walked into the airport lounge before my flight and saw a man sitting there, and I thought to myself, oh, look, it's Bob Dylan. As I chuckled to myself, I remembered that Bob Dylan had, in fact, played a show in my town the night before. Not sure exactly what to do and not 100% sure it was him, I decided to send him a drink as I left for my gate. I figured if it was Bob Dylan, then I'd just bought Bob Dylan a drink. And if not, well, I was getting on a flight, then I didn't have to worry about sending the wrong impression. As we mentioned earlier, airports are increasingly being used as backdrops for movies and television programs. NBC picked up LAX for its fall lineup. It's a drama about airport workers in LA's International Airport. Joining us now from his office at Universal Studios in California is Nick Thiel, creator and executive producer of LAX. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be on.
What made you think of an airport as a place to set a primetime drama?
Well, a lot had to do with what some of your callers were saying earlier, that you know, I always found airports to be an exciting place, and I, you know, liked hanging out there. In fact, when I was in college, I used to go sometimes at night and just hang out there for hours and watch the people. And I just started wondering who was running this place? I mean, what kind of jobs were there? What was happening behind those doors that passengers never go through?
Mm-hmm. And did you ever get anybody to let you through the doors?
Yes, I was taken on a behind-the-scene tour, a really great one. It happened the month before 9/11, so I was given complete access, more access than anyone can get now. And it was a fascinating tour, and I met all the people that ran things, and it made me feel a lot better about flying because they all made me feel much safer.
Is there a comparison in a way to showbiz? I mean, you're putting on the show in the main terminal floor for all the passengers, but then behind the scenes, there's all kinds of mechanics going on.
Well, you know, what's interesting, there is a lot of mechanics going on in the background that you don't know about, shuffling gates and shuffling runways. And, you know, the reason why your flights are delayed, you don't understand why there could be anywhere from 100 reasons why your flight's delayed. And it is a lot like a show, but these people are so professional that work there, they take it in a very calm fashion. They're not as nervous as us show business people are.
Describe the show for us. It's obviously about people who work at the airport.
Yeah, it's really like the behind the scenes. It's like going backstage of a play. It's what all the people that get you on your flight and landing safely and on as close to on time as they can possibly do. And I mean, I didn't realize how there's thousands of jobs that, you know, that have to be done to get you on and off your plane.
A lot of us consider an hour at an airport an hour in purgatory. How are you going to convince us to spend an hour in front of the TV?
But it's purgatory with Heather Locklear and Blair Underwood.
Ah, well, that improves it quite a bit.
Exactly.
You also have to overcome, I guess, the lasting impression of all those airplane movies.
Well, yeah, we do have to overcome that, but ours isn't like that. We're not going to be the disaster of the week. We're not going to be, you know, we'll probably never, ever have an episode about a terrorist. It is a drama, but it has a lot of light moments in it. And, you know, every year, and I thought this was an amazing statistic, counting people that drop people off, counting people that work there, counting people that are flying, 150 million people pass through LAX every year.
How many?
150 million.
My gosh.
That's half the population of the United States passes through LAX a year. There's 50 million passengers, but when you think of the cargo, the people that work there, the people that drop people off, pick people up, it's 150 million people, and each one can have a story. So, you know, we have an unlimited supply of stories that come in either through passengers or people who work there.
150 million stories at LAX. Yes,
in the big airport.
There you go. Pico Iyer was describing, he lived for a couple of weeks at LAX for a story. Really did pull a Tom Hanks. He was describing that to us earlier. But this is a big place. Is your drama set at the international arrivals or one of the domestic terminals, the LAX?
Well, it's the whole place. I mean, it really focuses on Heather Locklear's character is chief of airfield operations, which is the person in charge of everything outside, like runways and towers and baggage and stuff like that. And Blair Underwood's character is the terminal chief who is in charge of everything inside.
And
so
it
deals with the entire airport.
And I assume there's a complete cast of, zany sidekicks.
Well, I don't know if zany is the right word. There are a few of those, but yes, because they have huge amounts of support teams. I mean, we have baggage handlers as characters. We have airline supervisors that are characters. You know, we have a custom officer, a police officer, a immigration officer. I mean, LAX has its own FBI office, a CIA office. It has its own infirmary. It is a city.
Can you give us a preview of one of your plots? I assume it's one of those interlocking plots with more than one story.
We have multiple stories running through our show, and in the pilot, which is the first episode,
appropriately,
yes, and exactly, three of the stories in there came out of people telling me stories when I went on the tour.
Really?
Yeah. At LAX, they had a dog that got out of its crate and it was missing for 3 days in the airport. And they could not find it. They eventually found it in a ditch in between the two runways, and a pilot spotted it. But for 3 days, it was running loose in the airport. They never could get it. But they find it. So that's in the pilot. And there were drunk pilots that had to be stopped. That's in the pilot as well. And almost on a weekly basis, they have an unattended bag that they have to treat as a bomb. It's never been a bomb at LAX, but they have to treat it as a bomb every single time, which means they have to clear out 100 yards up, down, and sideways in the terminal.
And send one of those robots after it?
Yeah, they send one of the robots after, which is what we do in the pilot as well.
Huh.
And sometimes they have to blow it up, and sometimes they can just X-ray it and remove it. But they have to. It's got to be treated seriously every single time, because one time it might be a real bomb. So don't leave your bags unattended.
And we have to tune in to find out whether it goes off or not.
Exactly.
What night did you pull from the schedule on NBC?
It's Mondays at 10.
Well, good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much.
Nick Thiel is creator and executive producer of NBC's LAX, slated to debut this September. He joined us by phone from his office at Universal Studios in California.